Bone brother, everybody, we're in the same.
We got our theme struck. And I think we're joined by Dimitri Leskaris. Are you there, Dimitri?
I am. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, it's great to talk to you today. We've spoken to you in the past, and we've always been impressed with the work you've done and the efforts you put in.
Thank you.
And now you are running for the leadership of the Green Party, which we also find exciting because you seem to bring a lot of fresh ideas, and we want to get into that. Can you tell us, when is the Green Party going to choose its leader, and how does it go about it?
Well, the actual voting will begin electronically in September, and will conclude in early October. I believe the date of the actual announcement of the winner of the leadership contest is going to be October 3rd at our convention in Charlottetown. We have until early June to submit our nomination papers. Right now, there's about, it's not entirely clear because the number changes quite rapidly. But I believe there are around 7 candidates in the race at this time. And so others may enter the race because, as I said, you have until June 3rd to submit your nomination paper. So we have a pretty crowded and very diverse field in terms of political philosophy.
Yeah. Now, of course, there's a number of issues we want to ask, but I guess you understand that your daily activity now is affected by the current issue of the what is generally called the coronavirus, COVID-19. This is obviously impacting on you, even as a candidate, your ability to get around and have meetings. But are you beginning to address this as from the point of view, what you think the Green Party ought to be doing and what you think this current issue teaches us?
Sure. I mean, there's so many lessons to be drawn from it, and we won't really know exactly what it all means, signifies until it's played out. And I hope mercifully that will be relatively soon to the benefit of all the people who are being affected by this. But I've suspended my campaign, in-person campaigning. We are campaigning as of 2 days ago. We are campaigning entirely on a virtual basis. We have a couple other candidates who've done that. I wouldn't be surprised to see all of the candidates do that in short order. I think, of course, everybody is focused on the potential health consequences of the coronavirus, and they are quite serious. There's no doubt about that. And they're likely to prove at the end of the day to be, very painful for a lot of families in this country and around the world. But what I'm trying to impress upon people right now, because we're hearing a lot about the health implications, what I'm trying to impress upon people is that the economic implications are potentially even more disastrous. And it is absolutely imperative. Today the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 13% after a precipitous decline over the last couple of weeks. We are now into the territory of systemic financial risk. We are probably going to experience an extremely severe recession, depending upon the length of this the health crisis. Mm-hmm. It could be the most severe recession we've seen, and I don't want to alarm people, but it's possible it could be more severe than anything we've seen since the Great Depression. And I think we need to see dramatic action, radical action on the part of government to support Canadians, ordinary Canadians, and especially the most vulnerable Canadians. I think a good place to start is immediately implementing a guaranteed basic income for all Canadians is absolutely essential because, the entire industries are being shut down before our very eyes.
Yes.
The economy is closing down, not just here, but elsewhere, all around the world. And this is something unprecedented. And we need to see some really, really dramatic action from the government to protect the most vulnerable members of our society.
Mm-hmm. I notice in the United States that a couple of people picked this up. The interesting candidate, Tulsi Gabbard, I guess we call her the peace candidate, but she's even introduced legislation, I think. She's trying to get, $1,000 a month or something? I forget what it is, but she wants it to be guaranteed. And of all people, the former governor of Utah, Romney, was also a president. He also is advocating, but he's not ready to make it a regular thing. He's like an emergency matter. But it is being talked about, but you're the first voice that I've heard in Canada raise this.
Well, I just think it's so obvious. I mean, I think you're going to hear a lot more voices arguing for this in the future, and this should not be an exceptional measure. This is something, there's absolutely no reason why we allow anybody in our society, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world, to fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no reason why we would have tens of thousands of people living in the streets in normal conditions. Mm-hmm. But what we consider to be normal conditions, while 10 Canadians control $65 billion of wealth, mm-hmm. millions of people living in poverty, hundreds of thousands of children living in poverty. This is absolutely unacceptable. Mm-hmm. What I think is we have an extraordinary opportunity before us, as terrible as the situation is, to see what the fragility of our economy is, to see what the injustices of our society are, and to address them meaningfully on a permanent basis, not on a temporary basis, permanent basis. This is unacceptable under any condition, mm-hmm. especially under emergency conditions like those we confront.
Yes. Well, now that also is part of what I assume is your basic, I'm seeing the label, eco-socialist, which I appreciate, by the way, as an identifier. I'm glad the candidates say things like this so that I can get clear what it is they want other than good things. But could you talk a little bit why you chose, why you're comfortable with the term, and what does it mean?
Well, for me, it means not that we eliminate entirely private property, not that we eliminate entirely free enterprise, but what it means, at a sort of broad level is we restore our faith in government. And the role of government, the incredibly important government role that government has to play in our day-to-day lives, by controlling key industries for the benefit of the public, by ensuring that there is no homelessness, there is no poverty, by preventing the accumulation of extreme wealth, by ensuring that public resources are diverted to the people who are most in need of those resources. So, for example, we are spending billions of dollars a year in this country on subsidizing fossil fuels in the face of a climate emergency. That's absolute insanity. Mm-hmm. We're spending extraordinary amounts of money on the military when arguably we don't even need a military, and we certainly don't need to be stationing troops abroad and involving ourselves in the hegemonic ventures of the United States government. Mm-hmm. So socialism puts the people first. There are a lot of, socialism embodies a lot of diverse models and ideas. There's not one fixed idea, but the one overarching common theme to socialism is it puts the ordinary members of society and the most vulnerable members of society in particular first at the top of the government's priorities. And the people who least need the support of the government are well down the list. Mm-hmm. That's what a socialist society is.
Yeah. Which, by the way, echoes somewhere in the Bible. I think it's Jesus says that I am concerned about the least. The least shall be first.
I'm an atheist, Bill, but I personally believe that Jesus was a socialist.
He certainly, by the way, he's as radical as you are on that one. We're talking to Dimitri Lascaris, and he is a candidate for leader of the Green Party. And by the way, you're on Twitter. People should really now, they want to know what's going on. We're very fortunate, in my view, that Twitter is available to us because from day to day, hour to hour, people can find out what you're thinking, right?
Absolutely. And in many ways, it's one of the most democratic forms of communication we have as citizens because there is less filtering going on than you see, much less filtering, although there is filtering, mm-hmm. than you see in the corporate media. Mm-hmm. The corporate media has an extraordinary tendency to talk about the things that the wealthy want talk about.
Yes.
Because they own
those things, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're having a crisis of democracy across the board. I mean, even to the point where people don't know if there's going to be a vote tomorrow in Ohio, for example. But also, big media tells us who the candidates are, and then they also tell us, well, nobody's ever heard of this person, not adding, that's because they never mention this person.
Right. And so, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman did a wonderful job of explaining this to us in Manufacturing Consent. I read that book for the first time back in 2000. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't read it earlier. I read it for the first time in 2007. And I remember putting that book down, Phil, and I was indignant. Yes. Because I even though I had begun to open my eyes, I really had not appreciated the extent to which I had been misled by the corporate media in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And that is something, for us to really develop. What we have today in Canada is a quasi-democracy. It has elements of democracy, but it isn't a full-blown, robust democracy. And for us to actually achieve a full-blown, robust democracy, we have to understand who are the trustworthy sources of information and who is trying to lead us astray in order to benefit the elite. And if we don't do that, then we're not going to get to a robust democracy.
Yes. Well, I absolutely agree with that. A century and a half ago was probably better. I've actually read the debates between Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas. And in the old days, some of those papers would give you their entire debate. And that you could just be at home in somewhere in Indiana, and you could read what Mr. Douglas said, what Mr. Lincoln said. When you debate or when you are talking, they don't give me a text that I could just look at and know what you're saying.
Right. They'll give you the snippets that happen to serve the purposes of their corporate map.
Yeah, they give a snippet from you which they think they can make a mockery of, and then it's them, not you. But anyway, I really appreciate your point about the media. We're speaking again. It's Dimitri Lascaris. By the way, please go to, just put his name, Dimitri's name in, go to Twitter so that you can keep track of the contest, but also Dimitri's views. On this point about where we are in terms of a world, and now we say a pandemic, it raises another matter, and you've touched on it. I want to go back to that, is that we have the World Health Organization, which is giving us solid information, and then we have the states that are worried about their message, and particularly I'm thinking of Mr. Pompeo, Mr. Trump, who try to hang on to language which is weaponized. They want to call this virus, they want to call it the Wuhan virus. They want to, in the case of Islamic Republic, which is experiencing terrible moments now, as is Italy, and they have sanctions on these countries. Isn't this a time to put these things aside, particularly just on a pure public health? It isn't good or make us safer to not provide medical supplies to a place like the Islamic Republic.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, that country. A human being's worth is not determined by his or her passport. It's not determined by his or her nationality. The lives of Iranians and the people in Wuhan, the people in Italy, wherever it may be, are worth every bit as much as the lives of Canadians. We are all brothers and sisters. And I hope that this crisis will drive home, to our fellow citizens how absolutely essential it is that we be unified as a species, that all of humanity come together at this incredible, important time. It's not just coronavirus. It's not just this economic collapse that we are facing. It is also a climate emergency. It is also the proliferation of nuclear weapons. It is also the increasing contamination of our water supplies. We are confronting an extraordinary convergence of existential crises, and now more than ever, unity is necessary. And this kind of divisive talk that you're hearing, from Trump, this misogynistic, racist, bigoted dialogue, we need to...
Yes, I heard yesterday that he was looking to try to get a German company to produce an antidote, which would only be for the Americans.
Yeah, he's offering...
I couldn't not believe my ears.
Yeah, Bill, he's offering... I saw a report today that he was offering astronomical sums to this company to relocate to the United States, and the German government did not deny the truth of the story. And the German people are rightly very, very upset about this. Donald Trump sees this as a profit opportunity. How morally bankrupt must you be as a human being to see something like this as a profit opportunity?
Yes.
I have to say, I watched the debate last night with Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, and although you didn't see Biden use quite the same rhetoric of Trump, he was talking about this crisis as though it's a war. Everything in the United States gets analogized to a military conflict. This is not a war. This is a moment of where we need unity, where we need humanity, where we need intelligent scientific thought, and all of us need to come together.
Yeah, it's very important that these points. And by the way, I have to say, now I'm speaking to Dimitri Lascaris, I am not hearing a lot of that out of these our parties, and I understand that, of course, that's why the Green Party basically came into being. We talk about major decisions made in Canada, which appear to be just knockoff of what the United States does. And when someone says, well, is that best for Canada? It's what Mr. Trump wants. It's what Mr. Bush wants. It's what Obama wants, particularly in the case of warfare. But is that best for us? And I turned to Parliament, and as they say, it's crickets. And not a sound.
Not a sound. When it comes to foreign policy, Phil, the acquiescence of the Canadian government in the agenda of the United States government is shameful. Absolutely shameful. You know, we even in the age of Trump, with such an atrocious human being at the head of the United States government, our foreign policy is following in lockstep with U.S. government foreign policy.
Yeah, he's in Syria. He says he's there just to get the oil, and the American people tolerate that. Well, yeah. I should say, and of course, looking at Canada, why doesn't someone stand up in the Canadian Parliament and say, that's illegal, it's immoral, and that is something Canada should not be associated with?
Absolutely not. And one of the reasons why, it's the most important reason why I decided to do this is because I think we need somebody in Parliament standing up and saying the things that no one is saying that need to be said. And one of the things that absolutely needs to be said is that our foreign policy is a disgrace. It's a disgrace. You know, 2 weeks ago, our foreign minister, François-Philippe Champagne, had the audacity to talk, I believe it was in Montreal, at a major foreign policy conference, and to criticize the selective application of international law. I mean, this was outrageous because no one is more guilty of the selective application of international law than the Canadian government. This is precisely what the Trudeau government did. This is precisely what Stephen Harper's government did. It's been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. And at no point in time in my lifetime, I'm 56, I can't recall a single government that actually treated human rights as though they're universal. Mm-hmm. They are universal. And so
they weaponize it, right? I mean, in other words, it's selective. They pick out this one or that one.
Absolutely. And somebody needs to stand up at Parliament and call them out on this.
Yes.
It's not even, you could do it without even breaking a sweat, because the contradictions are so obvious.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you do, and this is the Taylor Report, and we have spoken to Dimitri in the past, you do something, and you've been doing something with your work and your life in recent years, and I would wish all members of Parliament would learn to do. That is, you get out and around in the world. You went to Venezuela at a time when our foreign minister was basically standing arm in arm with Vice President Pence, with whom we could dispense, to make a joke, and they were actually ganging up and basically talking like maybe they would break into Venezuela and overthrow that government. And you went down there. Now, to me, that's what we should, anybody who represents us, we should say, don't talk to me about this. Have you been over there? Have you gone? Have you talked to people? Do that as our elected representative, and then come back and tell us what you saw. But instead, we take our handouts from the Pentagon or NATO, and then we just repeat what they said.
Yeah, and you know, and Phil, what was really instructive for me from that experience is what I encountered when I came back. So I went down there, you know, I hired on my own dime a translator and a guide, and she was wonderful. And she told me right at the outset, she said, you know, I am a Chavista, but I am very critical of the Maduro government. I'm not at all happy with the Maduro government. I just want you to know where I'm coming from. And I said, well, I appreciate your transparency. Could you please take me to parts of the city where I can talk to people who both support the government and oppose the government? Mm-hmm. And I did. And what I found out was that, yes, there was a relatively well-to-do segment of the population, but not exclusively, but relatively well-to-do segment of the population that was adamantly opposed to Nicolas Maduro. And then there was a segment of the population which wasn't white, that was people of African origin, that was people of indigenous origin or mixed, who were overwhelmingly supportive of the Maduro government. And there was really a schism in the society which reflected, I think, what the priorities of the government had been. The government had not prioritized the needs of the wealthy. This government had prioritized more so the needs of the underprivileged. and had earned the enmity of the affluent classes. And that's what emerged for me personally. And I'm not saying, you know, that Nicolas Maduro's government has committed human rights violations. I'm not saying I'm a fan. I'm just saying that's what I saw on the ground. Mm-hmm. And when I came back and I reported this, and I did a little tour in Canada to four cities and went to speak to people, I was hounded, absolutely hounded by a small group of Venezuelan expats, you know, who accused me, openly accused me of being a paid agent of the government of Nicolas Maduro.
Yes.
Absolute nonsense. Yeah. You know, this is what happens in this country when you just
our leading parties hide behind such people, and we understand they have a right to a point of view, but we also have to say, well, it's like there are Cubans who live in Florida who don't like Cuba. Well, that would be the Cubans in Florida. The Cubans in Cuba don't necessarily like the Cubans in Florida.
Right.
And
right.
The idea that there's only one group that speaks for everybody. But, you know, again, getting out and around would help educate our MPs. And they do take the occasional paid-for trip to one or two places. But, you know, when there's a crisis, I'd like to see elected leaders who say, well, I'm going to go over there and have a look. You know?
Yeah.
And I'll come back and tell you what I find out.
Absolutely. There's no substitute for speaking to people who are actually living through a crisis and hearing what they have to say. It's absolutely no substitute. Mm-hmm. I did the same thing when, you know, Greece was going through the austerity crisis. Mm-hmm. The narrative we were getting here in Canada was that the Greek government was a profligate state, that the Greek people didn't work hard, that there was a lot of corruption in Greek society. Mm-hmm. There certainly was an element of corruption, but the corruption was overwhelmingly in the oligarchy, which controls the Greek economy, and the austerity program, which we were praising, or to a large extent was being praised in the Western media, was absolutely devastating to the Greek people.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely devastating. The unemployment rate was in excess of 25%. There was a 25% contraction of GDP. The suicide rate soared. The poverty rate soared. There was a massive brain drain in the country.
Yes.
Virtually none of that was being covered in the Western corporate.
No, instead we were repeating the old tropes about another culture. Oh, those are Mediterranean people. They don't like to work, et cetera.
Yes.
And again, we need, in my view, candidates who will get out and around, and I do congratulate you on that. By the way, now there's two points I want to make sure I cover. Because you have spoken out, you have been an activist, and you take this approach, my impression is that you're beginning, the Green Party is attracting people in the of the left, or certainly of NDP people, who wanted the NDP to do this, but the NDP is very NATO-ized and doesn't change. Indeed, they've been punitive towards people who've done what you've done.
Yeah, you know, and I have a lot of friends in the NDP, and I actually am a good friend of Nikki Ashton's. I supported her leadership bid. I think that we have a lot more in common with the NDP than we disagree on. I think I've said this repeatedly. I think that the real opponent in our political system is the liberal conservative duopoly, that we should look for ways to cooperate with the NDP. And if the NDP leadership is not going to listen to its base, and I don't think that that's what Jagmeet Singh is doing, by and large, then I invite members of the NDP, the grassroots with whom I have so much affinity, to come under the Green banner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need their help. I need the help of Greens who are eco-socialistically minded and who are progressive, strongly progressive in their thinking. And I think the vast majority of Green members are.
Yeah.
I need to bring together people who don't vote, who've given up the millions of Canadians on the electoral system, because they know that it serves the interests of the privileged more than it serves the interests of ordinary Canadians. We need to build a movement, and I think the best place to do that is the Green Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in saying that, by the way, you are also advancing beyond the previous approach of your more recent leadership. They've tended to be a kind of a one-note party, right? I mean, you're trying to make sure that people understand the human rights, the ecology, all these things. It takes a broad program. So eco-socialism is actually an advance over previous positions of the party, right?
Well, I think there's. It is true that the Green Party has placed an extraordinary emphasis in the past on sustainability and the climate crisis. And I completely support the party's determination and leadership's determination to deal decisively with that issue. But it also has in the past championed things beyond sustainability. For example, a guaranteed basic income, pharmacare, and so forth. I think it's more a question of emphasis rather than the party having been previously. So what I want to do, I want to communicate to workers in this country and to organize labor that we are on their side. I think we haven't done a good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I've heard over and over again, I don't think it's entirely true, but I understand why there's this perception that the Green Party is anti-labor. We're not. And I'm certainly not. I am an ally of labor.
And we could illustrate that. I think the last time I spoke with you, you were going to Oshawa, where the General Motors was closing the plant, and the I think it was a union-inspired group called Green Jobs Oshawa, if I got it right, but certainly the concept. Talk about that. What was your message to them, and what about this issue of getting electric vehicles?
Well, I think whatever we can use that plant for so many good purposes, and we have to consult the experts about the best way to make that use of that infrastructure. But we could do it for renewable energy. We could do it for electric vehicles. The fact of the matter is that there is this huge physical asset which is not being employed because the government doesn't have the courage to nationalize the asset for the benefit of workers. I was invited to speak, and I was passionately arguing for the very simple notion that this was a wonderful opportunity for the government to intervene, to preserve jobs, and not only preserve jobs, but to convert jobs from an industry that is actually contributing to the climate emergency into an industry that is contributing to the solution to the climate emergency. Hmm. And these are the kinds of things that we as Greens need to really begin to focus upon. Our interests in sustainability are aligned completely with the interests of workers. We simply need to give workers an alternative. We have to be able to convince them that they don't have to go and get a job in the fossil fuels industry to make a decent living. Yep. We have to give them alternatives. And I have no doubt that they will passionately embrace those alternatives if they're offered to them by the government.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely agree. And I think it was great that you went there. And their struggle is still continuing. I know they're having meetings. I'll bet they're going to be inviting you. This is Dimitri Lascaris, candidate for leadership of the Green Party. Dimitri can be found, of course. Go to Twitter so you keep track. Dimitri, we're very glad to talk to you. We look forward to talking to you again soon, because all these matters that you've been addressing are kind of urgent. So we'd like to get back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Always a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. This is Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're going to be talking to Zafar. But I think we have a little more of, we're going to pick up Leadbelly where we left him off on the same boat, brother. And we come back and we'll talk to Zafar Bengash.